Hey, Rav Kook. We are up to source sheet 12 in the ongoing series on the development of Torah Shebaal Peh, Torah Misinai, etc. And we are coming today to the end of a set of three, and next time I'd like to start a new module. The new module will deal, Be'ezrat Hashem, with a really central issue of machlokas, debate, dispute, why there is machlokas, what does it mean when there are different rabbis saying different things, and how those mesh together in terms of a concept of truth and reality. Really important things. A little bit philosophical on some level, but certainly very to the point when it comes to understanding the halachic system. That will take us into a discussion, hopefully, of the Mishnah and the Gemara, which is really, it's about time we got there, and we'll be discussing that. And by the time we've discussed the Mishnah and the Gemara, I suspect it'll be Purim, and I'm away between Purim and Pesach, so then we'll be talking about after Pesach, and we'll be doing some other things after Pesach on the same idea, but we'll get there when we get there. There are basically four or five important pieces of information I want to communicate this evening. Hello, pretty. And they are as follows. I want to talk about the built-in limits to the system of rabbinic legislation. Much of the halacha that we have today is midrabbanon. It comes from the rabbis. And we talked a lot about their authority, where they get their authority, and how far that authority goes. I want to talk today a little bit about what they can't do, and I'm not going to read every single source on the sheet, because I want to get through today's sheet entirely. And it basically goes like this. There are three things basically the rabbis can't do. They can't overrule the Torah itself, and we'll see there are exceptions to that. They can't often overrule each other, and we'll talk about how that works specifically. And also, they can't overrule the people. We'll see how that works, and we'll see what the kind of grassroots force of the people is in the system of rabbinic law. Remember that we talked a bit at the beginning of the year about that. The whole purpose of rabbinic law was this idea that there has to be a human element to the construction of the halakha. The halakha is coming, on the one hand, from above. It's coming from a divine source. It's theonomy, as Rav Eliezer Berkowitz called it. It's coming from outside of us, from God. But there also has to be a level of autonomy. It has to be coming from within us. And therefore, there is this concept of rabbinic legislation, which is temporary. We saw all the sources, which is designed to, if you like, update and constantly refresh the system. That's what it's designed for. Of course, the system doesn't work this way anymore. We don't anymore have a dynamic system in the sense that there can be changing rabbinic law, because we no longer have the rabbinic system. We don't have a Sanhedrin. We don't have the Beis HaMikdash. It's worthwhile remembering that when you daven for the Beis HaMikdash, it's not just some nice idea about, oh, we want Mashiach and everything will be nice and we'll have peace, which is great, of course, we want that, definitely. But I'm not belittling the idea at all, Chas V'Shalom. But it's also a very important part of our Jewish religion, just that the religion only works properly when it has all its institutions. We need a melech, and we need a Sanhedrin, and we need all of these things, the Beis HaMikdash. That's why we need to take three steps back. When you daven after Shemona Esei, Shibane Beis HaMikdash from Heira V'Yameinu, the first thing you say is, V'sein Chalkeinu B'Torasecha, then we will have a real chalek in the Torah, because the Torah will be, if you like, revitalized with the system that it really is meant to work under. We will see soon what system we have, and how the Gemara and the Mishnah works, and what we can do within the confines of that, but that's not yet. So the first thing to say is this, that the Torah basically sets the bar. The rabbis can't come along and say, oh, well, God says you can't eat pork, but we think you can eat pork. That they can't do that. And the Torah itself, the Gemara itself, expresses great outrage and surprise at the idea on this particular issue of Shemitah. Shemitah is not just an issue to do with agriculture. Shemitah is a halacha in Shemitah year, that at the end of the Shemitah year, every 7 years, all the loans which are owed, all the money which is owed to other people, gets cancelled out. Okay, that even applies today. If it's from Jewish people to Jewish people, they have to enter into a... unfortunately, not all of the non-Jewish people in the world have signed up to this idea fully, and we'd like them to, if they can. But certainly, the loans between Jewish people get cancelled out at the end of the Shemitah year. The purpose of this was to make sure that there wasn't an institutionalized poverty class. The idea that people are into never-ending debt. and spirals of debt, and debt that leads to debt. You see what that leads to in society, that you have a landed gentry, and you have a poverty-stricken, you know, working class, or a serf class, or whatever. In a halakhic system, that can't happen, or shouldn't happen, because A, every 7 years the debts are written off, and people can start from scratch, and B, every 50 years the land all goes back to the original people, so you can't end up with all the land being concentrated in the hands of a few rich people. The original people who had it at the times that when the Yovel was in place, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehudu, and all the tribes were settled in Israel, so there was a redistribution back of the land, so everything resets. There's a mini reset every 7 years, and there's a major reset every 50 years. So that's actually a very interesting system if you're ever looking at a writer paper as to whether Judaism, halakhic Judaism, in theory is communist or capitalist or interventionist or socialist or something like that. It's of course none of those buzzwords just on their own, but it certainly has an interventionist streak to it, which is part of what we're talking about today, yes.
But doesn't it reduce the incentive for people to
want
to give loans?
Mm. So that's the thing. So the Torah says, and don't let this for 1 minute stop you from giving loans, because that would be really wicked. Now of course, that's true, but the rabbis came along later and said, you know something? Unfortunately, people are sometimes really wicked. And one of the jobs of rabbinic legislation, we talked about this, is to deal with the fact that people don't live up to the expectations that the Torah has of them. We saw this, for example, with Iksubah. The Torah requires husbands to give certain things to their wives. It says in the Torah they what they have to do. Husbands are not always what they should be, so the rabbis had to jump in and put a contract in place called Iksubah. So look, sign on the dotted line, and it says here what you have to do. Even though the husbands really should have done it anyway, the rabbis had to kind of reinforce that. Here too, the rabbis came and they invented this thing called prosbul. What's a prosbul? You ever heard of a prosbul? A prosbul is a contract that you put in place where you assign your loans over to the Beis Din at the end of the Shemitah year, and loans owed to Beis Din don't get cancelled out by the Shemitah year. That way your loan will continue and it won't get cancelled out by the Shemitah year. So on the one hand, this is actually good because it's keeping the spirit of the law. It's not circumventing the spirit of the law. Because Chazal were trying to find a way to make sure that rich people would lend to poor people, and in this circumstance they would only lend to them if they knew they were going to get their money back. So it was actually clogging up credit lines, this halacha. So they put in place this thing called prosbul, which is very nice. On the other hand, how can they do that? The Torah says that the loan is cancelled. How can the rabbis invent something which prevents the Torah? There's a mitzvah to positively cancel your loans. And the rabbis are saying, oh no, you don't need to do that. How can they do that? You're overriding the Torah. So have a look in number two. One and two are practically the same source. So two's got the punchline. So the Torah says, Gemara says, Amika midim idoraisa loy masham tashvir. How can you have a situation where the Torah says the loan is not written off? And the rabbis have made a takana that it is written off. It's not written. They've changed the whole thing. Amar Abaya, the Abaya answers and says as follows: Shev va'al tasehu. It's a shev va'al taseh. What does that mean? Literally, sit and don't do anything. And this is a very important halachic principle. The rabbis, correct, don't have the ability to override the Torah actively. They can't say, break the Torah, eat pork, eat on Yom Kippur, drive on Shabbos. They can't say that. But what they can do, and they often do where they feel that there's an overriding need, is where the Torah says you have to do something, they require you to passively not fulfill what the Torah requires you to do. And that's called a shev v'al taseh. And that's the one thing the rabbis do have the right to do, and that they often do. I'll give you some examples. The Torah says you have to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Whenever Rosh Hashanah falls, it doesn't specify specific days you have to blow, even if it's on Shabbos. It just says, on Rosh Hashanah you blow the shofar. So it would apply every day of the week. It would also apply on Shabbos. Chazal were worried that on Shabbos, if people have to blow the shofar, they'll carry the shofar to shul, and they'll break Shabbos in order to do the mitzvah of blowing shofar. So they said, no, you're not going to blow shofar on Shabbos. And taka, we have a law, we have a locha. If it's Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. Which is interesting, because the Torah says you should blow the shofar, and yet Chazal have removed that mitzvah passively because of the possible breach of Shabbos, even though many places had an Eruv, and it wouldn't have been a problem anyway. So they're only worried that someone is inadvertently going to win somewhere where there's no Eruv, yet they felt that Shabbos was important enough to override the actual Torah mitzvah of blowing shofar. It's a remarkable thing if you think about it. It shows you how important Shabbos is. Similarly with Lulav, on the first day of Sukkot, There's a mitzvah in a Torah to shake lulav on the first day of Sukkot. If that happens to fall on Shabbos, the rabbis have cancelled it. They said, no, you can't, you don't do it, because it's a passive breach, if you like. They discontinued the whole parsha of the Sota, the suspected adulterous woman. They said, no, we're not going to do that anymore, for all sorts of reasons. The whole ritual of Egla Rufa, there's a whole mitzvah in the Torah, which says if you find a dead body and you don't know who killed it, there's a whole procedure you have to do, you have to measure to the towns and to work out. They cancel all of that. So for various different reasons, the rabbis sometimes felt that they could and should override a mitzvah in a passive way. So just in case you ever wonder how that happens, this is how it happens. If the Torah specifically tells you you have to do something in a specific way, then it's very difficult for the rabbis to say that you can't. For example, the Torah specifically says you do bris milah even on a Shabbos. Even though bris milah is breaking Shabbos, there's a specific pasuk that comes to say do bris milah on a Shabbos. So Chazal didn't feel there, since the Torah specifically pointed to it, that they could take it away. That's why we still do bris milah on the Shabbos. Think about it. Why don't we say, oh, no bris milah on the Shabbos, in case there's more chance that someone's going to carry something for a bris than for blowing the shofar, you know? They're going to carry the knife, they're going to carry the baby, they're going to carry the presents, I'm going to carry, I don't know what they're going to carry. That the posuk specifically says you're allowed to do that, because it's mitzvah of milah. Otherwise we wouldn't be allowed to do bris milah, because it's breaking Shabbos. It's one of the 39 malachas. But we can do bris milah because of the Torah says so, and the rabbis didn't put that to side. So that's the first point I want to make. The rabbis can override the Torah in a passive way, sheva al tasa. The next point. There is a concept of something called a horas shah. The Rambam talks about it in number 3. Have a look, I'll just read the first two lines of this. The rabbis can uproot any Torah mitzvah on a temporary basis. Even though they're smaller than the previous based in, even divrei Torah themselves, that's based in, can override on a temporary basis. Now, what have we been talking about up until now is permanently. The rabbi said permanently, no one's allowed to blow the shofar on Shabbos from now on until, you know, we get the next Sanhedrin. So that they can do. But they can't permanently override an active breach of the Torah, but on a temporary basis they can. And he brings examples, for example, you know, Shlomo HaMelech and his Sanhedrin overrode the mitzvah of Yom Kippur when they inaugurated the first base of Mikdash. They cancelled Yom Kippur just for that year. They said there's no Yom Kippur this year, it's too happy. You know, even though Yom Kippur is a happy day, they said no, we can't have fasting when we're inaugurating the Yom Kippur, the base of Mikdash. So they cancelled it. And other things you see as well, through Tanakh, you sometimes see people in Tanakh doing things that seem to be against the mitzvahs of the Torah themselves. So sometimes Chazal come in and explain this was a horah shah. Classic example, Eliyahu HaNavi bringing up a korban on Mount Carmel, even though that is a prohibition in the Torah. You're not allowed to bring a korban on a private mizbeach, on a private altar, when the Beis HaMikdash is in existence. Eliyahu HaNavi did this. It was based on a horah shah because there was a need at the time. Sanhedrin can do this, and a Navi can do this as well. You had a question?
Yeah. How long is like a temporary business?
Anything that's not now enshrined in the halachic system.
So could be like 100 years temporary?
I don't know. That sounds pretty permanent to me. I don't know the specific. Whenever you see examples of this, it was always a one-off, as far as I'm aware. It was a one-off. The Gemara gives examples in number 4. They needed to, at the time of the Hanukkah revolt, they needed to really make a stand. They need, like sometimes they do today, like with drugs crime. People get disproportionate punishments for owning, you know, 2 ounces of marijuana because they feel that there's a need to make a statement. You see this sometimes. We see all this the same thing. In the time of the Hashmonaim, they executed a guy for breaking Shabbos on a rabbinic level. Yeah, even though he only rode a horse on Shabbos, but he was doing it to make a point, and they decided here and now we're going to make a point here as well, and they did that. But it was only on a temporary basis. They can't make a new halacha for to cancel out a Torah law like this. Yes.
It sounds a lot like the same as the end justified the means.
Yeah, and in fact, the Rambam gives exactly that idea. He says that sometimes you're allowed to chop off a person's, you must chop off a person's arm, a doctor has to chop off a person's arm to save the body. How can you mutilate somebody? The answer is, the hence justified the means. Yes, I'm going to chop off your arms and legs, but I'm going to save your life. Don't knock it. So that's one important thing, although again we don't do this today. No rabbis have this authority today. All of the things I'm talking about already have ceased to have any active effect, but just so you understand the system, how things work sometimes in Tanakh and how things work as we say when you shofar falls on Shabbos, etc. Now, just a couple of words on Baal Tosef. Yeah, question, Rivka?
Yeah, we would talk about what is the rabbinic authority nowadays.
Yes. No is the short answer, but I made a little advert last week, and I'll do it again. I'm in the process of giving four lectures specifically on that issue, on the issue of Das Torah and rabbinic authority today, and why we have to listen to the rabbis, if we have to listen to the rabbis, which areas, and those, there will be a separate little section on my website. Dealing with, you know, data and rabbinic authority for Shiurim. Look out for them, because I put a lot of work into it and hopefully they'll be helpful. Okay.
Can you write your website on the word?
RabbiManny.com. It's really easy. Yeah, it couldn't be any easier. Okay. So you'll find it. And you can also like the Facebook link page so that you'll get the updates and all that. It's all very streamlined now that my wife sorted it all out. Now, you should be thankful. For years I was apologising every class about my website. I'm sorry, it's not updated, it doesn't work, and this and the other. Baruch Hashem, now it does. Now, Baal Tosef. There's a mitzvah in the Torah. Many people may have thought this or wondered this. There's a mitzvah in the Torah not to add on to the mitzvahs. How can the rabbis do that? Surely they're breaking that mitzvah every time they add on extra mitzvahs. Halakha number 5 says the Torah, "Lo tosif al hadavar asher anochi mitzaveh etchem." Don't add on to what I'm commanding you to do. "Lo tisgar umimenu," and don't delete, don't take away from it. "Lishmaris mitzvos Hashem Elokeichem," you have to guard, you have to look after the mitzvahs. "Asher anochi mitzaveh etchem," those ones I do tell you, don't add new ones and don't take them away. How can the rabbis add rabbinic law? So the answer is, there's a number of answers actually, but the two answers that I've brought you here from the Ramban in number 6. He asked the question, he says, when the rabbis added extra things as a new, if you like, restriction, as a fence to protect the Torah, he gives an example of second degree incestuous relationships, or things like that. First of all, they're allowed to do that because they're actually obliged to do that. We saw that in the first year on rabbinic legislation. They have a specific mitzvah to create rabbinic laws. So you can't tell the rabbis on the one hand, you have a mitzvah to do this, and by the way, if you do it, you're doing an aveira. That doesn't make any sense. The Torah has to fit together as a system. And secondly, and this is very important, and they have to make it very clear when they make the new mitzvah that this is not coming as a new Torah mitzvah. That this is a specifically different kind of mitzvah. This is a rabbinic mitzvah. And that's why, guys, one of the reasons it's very important to know what's awesome in a Torah and what's awesome in Rabbanon. Apart from the fact you have to know that because the halachic process takes that factor into account, we'll see in a minute, there are different ways of dealing with rabbinic and Torah laws. But leaving aside that, the theological problem with rabbinic laws, if you think that they're Torah laws, is that you're adding on to the Torah. Have a look in number 7 for a second. Says the Rambam, "Im yavo beis din v'yata basar chaya v'chalav." If the Beis Din comes and they allow meat with milk, meat basar chaya means meat from a wild animal like venison, which the Rambam would hold. Not everybody agrees with. So the Rambam holds is fleishik min haTorah. Okay, harizeh goreah, but they allow that with milk, so that's taking away from the Torah. Ve'im yasa basar ha'oif, and if the rabbis come and say chicken is prohibited. Ve'yomer, and they come and say shebichlal hagidi, chicken is now included in the word gidi. Remember, loisav ashel gidi b'chalav imoy, sorry. Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. And the rabbis say that chicken is now included in that prohibition. V'hu osam in haTorah, and that it's osam in haTorah. Harizeh moisif, that's an issa, they're not allowed to do that. That's adding to the Torah. Avalim oimer, but if they say to you, no, basa ha'oif mutam in haTorah, really chicken is mutter, according to Torah law, to eat with milk. And it is. Chicken is parav, according to the Torah. The amu nesa, I say, and we are making it rabbinically prohibited, for nadiya la'am shehu gezerah, and they let the people know that it's, quote-unquote, only a gezerah. Ain't there moisif? That's not called adding on to the Torah. Ela oisif yag, that's called protecting the Torah. V'chein fiyoli yotiva. And therefore, it's critical to know the difference between Torah law and rabbinical law, not just to be able to get it right, but also to say that you're not adding on to the Torah. I brought you a number of examples here, just on a very broad brush. I'm doing this quite fast because I don't want to spend my... Look, you could spend 20 shirim on rabbinic law. You know, I've got a set of books at home, like about 1,000 pages thick on different kinds of rabbinic law. And, you know, we can't spend that long. But I brought you here some classics. Generally, in a case of doubt, when there's a Torah law, and I'm not sure whether I fulfilled it or not, I ate matzah, but then somebody told me, I'm not sure if that was the matzah which was kosher matzah or it was not kosher matzah, maybe that was the chometz matzah, I'm not sure you ate matzah, did I or didn't I? So the answer is, sofik d'oraisa l'chumra, I have to eat it again. Whereas usually in a rabbinic law we say sofik d'rabbanan l'kula. If you're not sure whether you did a rabbinic mitzvah or not, then often, not always, and you have to learn the halach in each case, you might not have to do it again necessarily. In a case of a machloikis between rabbis, we will often follow a lenient opinion in a rabbinic mitzvah, but we will often follow a stricter opinion in a Torah mitzvah. Rabbinic prohibitions are sometimes set aside in case of illness, pain, significant financial loss. Not always, every case is different, but on Shabbos, for example, many rabbinic mitzvahs on Shabbos are set aside for people who are sick. Not life-threateningly sick, just sick. They've got flu, in bed. Many mitzvahs, drabbanan, are no longer apply. And if you don't know which ones they are, either you'll just break Shabbos, because Torah mitzvahs are not set aside for someone who's just got the flu. So either you'll break Shabbos, which is really bad, or you won't look after the person, because you don't know what you can do, which is also really bad. And therefore you have to know those as well. Rabbinic prohibitions are generally set aside in front of personal dignity. That's a really interesting sugya in and of itself. Kavod habrias, there's a general law with rabbanon that where a person is about to be publicly embarrassed in a way which is really objectively embarrassing, very often rabbinic mitzvahs will be set aside to prevent them that embarrassment. There are lots of really fascinating examples of that, which I'm not going to get into now, but again, I gave a show on it recently, and there's one on the web if you're interested in it. And there's other things as well. We can trust a child with a rabbinic mitzvah, we don't trust a child with a Torah mitzvah, and other things like that. Fine, let's go on. So that's in terms of the rabbi setting aside the Torah. The second thing being, the rabbis cannot always override each other, so I want to come back to my favourite little drawing on the board, which I haven't drawn for about 4 or 5 weeks, so I'm already feeling withdrawal symptoms. Oh dear.
Time to invest in some new equipment, I think.
Uh-oh.
Right. Fine. We'll just have to live with that. Now, remember the three columns? Remember my three columns?
Yeah.
So here is Halacha, Moshe, Misinai. The first column, the first type of oral law is stuff that came down from Sinai. The second column is Drashot, meaning stuff that's learned from the verses. Here's a verse, and you learn out of Halacha, and the rabbis learned Halachot from the verses, okay, in the Torah. That's also in our Torah. And here this is Rabbinic Law. Rabbinic Law, okay? Comes along the Rambam and explains how this works. Number 8. Based in Godel, the Supreme Court, Shedarshu Ba'achas Min Amidas, who learned from a drosha, learned from one of the 13 principles, or the many principles through which they can learn out halach from the psukim. Kifi Masha Nirabei Neim, according to what they felt the psukim meant. And we'll talk about this when we talk about machlokas, how people can look at things, the same thing and see different things in it. Shehadin Kach V'danuk Din, and they ruled, we think the psukim mean this. This is the halacha. Va'amad achrehim based in acher, and then later, in another generation, a based in comes along, v'nira loy tam acher, and they think they have a different approach, a different reason, lister oisa, and they want to contradict the first based in, harivim oisa, they can contradict, totally. V'dan kefim asher nira beinav, and they can rule according to whatever they feel is the right answer. Sh'nemar, ala shofet, asheyiyah b'yamim ahem, you go to the judge which is in your day, you only have to go according to your own base din, which is very interesting because that builds in maximal flexibility to the system in the sense that the psukim are there, the rabbis are learning new ideas out from the psukim. I'm not talking about chumash in terms of like pshat, I'm talking about halacha. Again, we don't do this today, okay? But when they did this, any base thing was able to override a previous base thing, whether it was bigger or smaller or greater or lesser, because again, built into the system had to be this element of flexibility, of responsiveness, and therefore the Rambam is very clear that any base thing could override any other base thing, as long as it was really a Sanhedrin, even if they were smaller or not as great in wisdom, we'll see now. Yeah, Nava.
Was this until the printing press came out?
No, this was way before the printing press. Oh. This already ceased to have effect when the Sanhedrin ceased to have power, which is even, basically when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed.
We'll talk about the Shulchan Aruch.
Right. We'll talk about the Shulchan Aruch. The way that halacha works today, there's a long way to go. The way halacha works today, you've got to stay with this course all to the bitter end, you know? Even if you join in the middle and you leave in the middle, you have to stay with it, otherwise you'll only have like a snippet. And we'll be going through till the summer, Be'ezat Hashem, and perhaps even beyond. So the way that halacha works today is completely different. And today we have to ask the question, which rabbis are allowed to disagree with which rabbis? Is there anyone that can turn around today and say, line drawn, you can't disagree with me. I am now setting the bar for whatever comes afterwards, or not. And it's not so straightforward. And we'll see that it's, after the Gemara, the basic principle is anyone can disagree with anyone if they're qualified to disagree with them. Okay? But we'll see later how that works. Now, over the page to page 3. That was all in terms of column number 2, in terms of learning things from Sukkim. What about Gezeirus? What about if the rabbis want to make rabbinic laws? So here, interestingly, the halacha is stricter. Number 9. Based in Shagazru Gezeira or Tiknu Takana, the Hinhigu Minhat, are based in the creator new Takana or Gezeira, and we talked about the difference between Takanas and Gezeiras. If you don't remember, then look at the last sheet, or the one before. Upasha Tadava Bechol Yisrael, and it's spread through the Jewish people. We'll see why that's important in a minute. The Amad Achreihim based in Achera, and another based in comes along later. Ubikesh Levatl Dvarim, and they want to cancel it, Dvarim Arishonim. They want to cancel the decree. A later Beis Din says, later Beis Din comes and says, we don't like Hanukkah anymore. Nah. Hanukkah, it was nice for a couple of hundred years, but we're sick of it now. We want to do something different on in the middle of December. We're going to go ice skating for 8 days instead of light candles. Yeah? But it's like Zerubah, they want to cancel it. They want to cancel the old halacha. Says the Rambam, and the Rambam's not making this up, the Rambam's getting this from the Gemaras. Einu yochel, they can only do that, actually ye godl min arishonim b'chochma u'b'minyin. They have to be greater than the earlier Beis Din in wisdom and in number. B'ha godl b'chochma, if they were greater in wisdom, aval loy b'minyin but not in number. B'minyin, or in one number, aval loy b'chochma but not in wisdom. Einu yochel levatel et dvarav. You can't cancel the earlier one. Afilu bottle hatam, and here's where it gets interesting. Even if the reason for the earlier gezeira goes away, shebiglalo gazra rishen, for the reason for the original ones making the gezeira, or hitkino, or ein ha'cherim yicholim lebattle, the later ones cannot get rid of it, actually gedolim mehem, until they are greater. And he just adds one interesting point. We haven't finished with that point about the reasons, but we'll come back to it. How can you have a Beis Din which is greater in number than a previous Beis Din? Every Sanhedrin had the same number of people. They all had 71. So what does it mean a Beis Din greater in number? Says the Rambam, the Hechiyu Gedoyle Mehem B'minyan. How can you ever have a greater number? However, kol Beis Din or Beis Din shall shiva ve'echad hi. Who? There's always 71 people. He says the answer is number means number means the number of people in the generation who support the Gezeirah, who support that Beis Din. Sha'amru Beis Din Agadol V'lo Chalkul. Very interesting. The Beis Din is only as strong as the people who support it, which is a fascinating idea. Even though you have this court which has authority over the people, and yet the court runs the people doesn't run the court. But on the other hand, if the court loses its support from the people, it loses its authority. Which is really very interesting. Because built into the system, we'll see more so soon, even more directly, built into the system is a kind of grassroots checks and balance. That a later Beis Din will be considered greater if more people support it. Now, what we have here in the Rambam is basically a statement, which is the halacha, certainly as far as he's concerned, which is an earlier Beis Din, if it made something, and later Beis Din is not greater in support, then that's it, you're stuck with the earlier Beis Din. That means effectively, this is one of the reasons why, one of a number of reasons why, we effectively have a fixed Talmudic system now. Because the rabbinic laws which were brought in by the Sanhedrin, and if you like, by the Mishnah, which there was still a Sanhedrin at the time of the Mishnah, just about, or was there, it's not quite clear because it didn't have its full authority, but let's say there was. We no longer have a Sanhedrin, or even the potential to have a Sanhedrin, which is greater, because we don't have one at all. And therefore, whatever rabbinic laws we have in the system of the Talmud now, we have. Until such time as a greater Beis Din comes along, which means we put together a new Sanhedrin and then we can rethink things, we are now stuck with those halachas. And it seems from the Rambam fairly clear that even if the reason goes away, We're still stuck with the halacha. But that's not so clear. Because I brought you an alternative opinion of the Ravid in number 10 that actually says, he brings some examples of situations where actually lesser batidin overruled earlier batidin which were greater, because the whole reason for the thing went away. He gives a particular example about bringing Bikurim. There was a special takana that they dressed up Yerushalayim in a certain way in order to bring the first fruits. And when the temple was destroyed, they stopped that. So he asked, how can they stop that? The Sanhedrin after the temple was destroyed was lower than the one before. The answer is, because the whole purpose went away. The whole purpose was to make Yerushalayim look nice. Now Yerushalayim is a churban, it's destroyed. And this opens up a fascinating issue, which I'm not going to deal with in full now, because I want to give a whole share on this, in this series, which is, what do we do with halachas, rabbinic halachas, where it seems very clear they have a very specific reason? And that reason now doesn't apply. Do we still have the halacha, or do we scrap it? Now, when it comes to Torah mitzvahs, we never really know the reasons for Torah mitzvahs. We can surmise, maybe it's because of this, maybe it's because of that, but when you're dealing with a mitzvah which effectively is coming min hashamayim, and you have an infinite source with an infinite number of reasons, you're never going to be able to turn around and say, oh yeah, we know the reason, it's gone, finished. That's not something we can do, logically. What do you mean? Well, no, there's two things with Havrasha. No, well, you see, you're only giving half the story, Yoni, excuse me. Because there's two mitzvahs of Havrasha Chala. There's, number one, to take something out of the Chala and not to eat it, because to show that the Chala doesn't belong to you, there's a bit that belongs to God, number one. And two, to give that to the Kohen. So there's two elements to that mitzvah. Now, you're right, the second part doesn't apply, because we can't give it to the Kohen anymore, because the Kohen can't eat it, because they're all Tamei. But the first part still applies, in the sense that we can still take a bit out of our challah as a, if you like, as a gesture to say that we recognize the food is not ours, it's given to us as a gift, and therefore we're giving a little bit back, if you like. And that's what we do. We take our challah, which is Doraisa, certainly in Israel, but we don't give it to the Kohen, because we can't, because he can't eat it. So we throw it away. Okay? So, but sometimes, even more obviously the reason, by the way, that's a Torah mitzvah as well, not a rabbinic mitzvah. But sometimes there's a rabbinic mitzvah where the reason really just goes away. For example, the rabbis made a gezeira, you're not allowed to drink. They were very strict about this. Takana, really, not a gezeira. You're not allowed to drink liquids, certain liquids, wine, water, and milk, which has been left unsupervised any time, any day, because they were worried there were snakes around, and the snakes went to drink, and when the snake drinks, it deposits a little bit of its venom in the thing. And this was not just some kind of weird, Kabbalistic, you know, this was a real concern, a real health concern. And they made a clear gezeira, it's also, if this water was left uncovered in the room and I went to the other room, it's also for me to drink. Comes along in the Middle Ages, the Balei HaTosfos, and say, very nice, we understand that totally, it's totally logical, they had a reason, but the reason just doesn't apply, we just don't have those snakes, therefore the halacha's gone, finished. And the Shulchan Aruch actually rules, yeah, the halacha's gone. The halacha, which is undisputed, absolutely clear in the Gemara, it's now no longer on the books. And therefore, even though some people tend to feel that we end up left with, you know, vestigial remains of mitzvahs that no longer apply, that's not really the case. When it comes to Torah mitzvahs, they always apply. When it comes to rabbinic mitzvahs, very often when there's a clear reason, then the reason has gone away, then we do away with the mitzvah. Now, sometimes it's not always clear what the reason is. For example, Mayim Achronim, the rabbi said there's a mitzvah to wash your hands after the meal before you bench. Now, if that's because of the salts, a specific kind of salts, and we don't have the salt anymore, so there's no reason to do it. But if there are other reasons, which might be Kedusha and this and that, so that we still have Kedusha, we still have that, so there you end up with a machlokas to do it or not to do it. But there are some interesting applications, and I'm just going to whet your appetite now, but I'm not going to go into it. For example, there is a mitzvah on the books that a woman is not allowed to, a rabbinic takana, a woman is not allowed to remarry within 24 months of having a baby. Let's say the woman got divorced, or the husband died, God forbid. She cannot marry another man for 24 months after having the baby. Why? Yeah, so what's going to happen with the milk?
Because, if she will have another kid,
that's right, she'll marry a new guy. She'll get pregnant. And by the way, you can get pregnant if you're feeding a baby. Don't trust it. It's not a good form of birth control. Okay, many people have found that out and ended up happy mummies because of it. But one thing's for sure, if they do get pregnant, the milk will dry up because the body will not grow a new baby and feed an old one at the same time. So if the milk dries up, the baby's obviously not going to be on solids, because they fed the babies, you know, they breastfed the babies for a couple of years at least. Okay? So where's she going to get milk for the baby? So she's going to have to hire a wet nurse. So how's she going to hire a wet nurse? She's got no money, because why would she have money? Because she has no job. Because women just didn't have independent sources of income on the whole. So she's relying on the stepfather to hire a wet nurse to feed the baby. Why is he going to be bothered? It's not his baby. So Chazal made a gezeira, a takana rather, for the protection of the young child, to stop the young child being deprived of nutrients. Fine. Today, for any number of reasons, that whole scenario doesn't play out. Number one, the babies aren't fed on milk, on breast milk for 2 years. If they are breastfed at all, they're breastfed for a few weeks till, you know, they give up and they do something else, whatever. And sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, I'm not doing down breastfeeding. It's a very important thing. But also, there's any number of sources of other milk for the babies. Even if the baby's drinking milk for months and years, you can go to the supermarket and get formula. And anyway, women have their own money. They have their own jobs. They're not relying on. There's any number of reasons why this is not relevant today. On the contrary, a woman could come along to the basin and say, look, I found this wonderful guy. My husband Nebuch died a year ago. I want to get married to this new guy. He has a guaranteed financial security. It's good for the baby. It's good for the baby. Not bad for the baby. Are you telling me I can't get married? And that's very interesting. Because, you know, you have to really get into the, well, what were the reasons? Were these the only reasons? Are there other reasons? And different Batei Din will take different approaches on today, halacha l'maisa, on this particular issue. It's very interesting. And there are many other areas as well, but it's for a different shira. I'm just really giving you a little bit of a preview. Coming soon. I don't know how soon, but coming. Yeah.
Last week when we were discussing, didn't Rambam say that, you know, we don't understand the reason behind the reason that we're going to call the judgment, or also the ways, or right now?
You said two things there. The Rambam definitely said that the mitzvahs, every mitzvah drabbanon is a mitzvah doraisa. Okay? That, he said. He didn't say we don't understand the reasons. I don't think. The Rambam didn't say that. Even if you say that there's a mitzvah doraisa with every drabbanon, you could still say there's a mitzvah doraisa to keep the drabbanon, as long as the drabbanon reason applies. Yeah? Once the reason doesn't apply, then there's no reason to keep the drabbanon. But once the reason doesn't apply, we're not overriding the drabbanon, we're just saying, well, they only made it for that reason. I'll give you an example, a modern day example. Chazal made a gezeira that milk that is milked by a non-Jew is potentially adulterated with milk from a non-kosher animal. This was standard, and still is standard in many parts of the world. Okay, they'll put a bit of milk from a camel, a bit of milk from a pig, a bit of milk from a horse, a bit of milk from a cow. They'll put it all together. You can't drink the milk if there is a chance that there is an adulteration with a non-kosher animal. Because the non-kosher milk is trade on a Torah level. So the milk has to be milked or supervised at least by a Jew. Chalav Yisrael. Comes along Rav Moshe Feinstein and said, of course that mitzvah still applies. We're not overriding that mitzvah. But the mitzvah is, if you are concerned that there is a doubt as to whether the milk could be adulterated, that's where Chazal made that mitzvah. They made that rabbinic law. But if there is no doubt as to whether the milk is adulterated, you can say with absolute certainty that the milk is pure cow's milk, then they never made any kind of takana or gezeira in that circumstance. That's why he allows you to drink milk which is unsupervised by Jews, because he says there is no concern, zero almost concern, that the milk in America today is going to be from a trefa animal, because of the potential repercussions with the farms if they found that they were, you know, doing this. Although it must be said, it's a funny thing, this week there was a massive controversy in London, in England. They found that many of the beef burgers that were being sold in the supermarkets were 30% horse meat. Completely against the law, completely, you know. And therefore, I wonder actually, even today, whether, you know, supervision is as strong as it should be. But that's a separate issue. Rav Moshe felt it was, and for milk it probably is. But you never know. So I'm just saying, you have to understand each gezeira in turn. Now, the last thing. Go to page number 4, please. One last thing, sorry, before we go to page number 4. The Rambam has a specific shita, which not everybody agrees on. But when it comes to gezeiras to protect us from doing an aveira, he says they can be never be overridden, even by a future Sanhedrin. Whether we pass like that, we'll see when we next get a Sanhedrin, whether they do override things. But this is an interesting issue, because one of the messianic impetuses in the Jewish people, whenever they feel that the Mashiach's on the way, is not just to get Mashiach, but just to get a new Sanhedrin. And don't forget, we need the Sanhedrin before Mashiach. Mashiach doesn't come and constitute the Sanhedrin.
No.
One of the things he does is build the Beit HaMikdash, and he brings in the Kibbutz Goliath, but we need the Sanhedrin to give Mashiach the stempel of approval.
That's what elections for
are. On a number of situations throughout Jewish history, there have been people pushing really hard to reestablish the Sanhedrin. It happened in the 16th century in Sfat, after the destruction of Spain, when the Jews came and they were living in this kind of post-Holocaust, Mashiach-oriented fervor. They felt, we'll reset up the Sanhedrin, and there are certain technical hurdles to do that, but I'm not getting into them now. And it's happened again in our own times. When the State of Israel was declared, there were quite a few people that felt this, the next logical step has to be putting together a Sanhedrin. And there is even a group of people that put themselves together about 20 years ago and said, we are now going to be like the Sanhedrin. It never really got off the ground. It was never really respected for all sorts of reasons. This group of people exist. They call themselves the Sanhedrin. I mean, they're not like, it's more a kind of a discussion group than a Sanhedrin. I don't think they really feel that they are the supreme authority for Klal Yisrael. I really don't think that, because they're sensible people. But they have something they call the Sanhedrin. It has a website, thesanhedrin.org or something like that. But you can have a look at it. But I'm saying that this is a real issue, because the Sanhedrin opens the way for a whole new approach to halakha, which of course is one of the reasons why, there's a lot going on here. One of the reasons why certain parts of the Jewish people are anti-Zionist, or at least are paranoid about Zionism, is because coming along with religious Zionism, at least, comes this messianic push, which also pushes in these kind of directions, which pushes for a new Sanhedrin, an analysis of halacha, maybe a new approach to halacha. And whenever you see, you know, these debates happening, you know, is the halachic system a little bit frozen today? Should we be readdressing certain issues, you know, agunas and this and that? Lurking behind the scenes are these kind of Sanhedrin Mashiach agendas, which are real in people's minds, and some people are very excited by them, and some people are really nervous about them, and that's underlying. It's not just that people are randomly Zionist or anti-Zionist. Going into that whole thing is a lot of different factors, and this is just one of them. If you're interested, read Rav Eliezer Berkowitz. He has a lot of writings on the philosophy of halacha, and one of the things he goes, like, at the end of his books, he kind of is over the deep end about the need to completely reconstitute the halachic system now that we're in Israel. And he was an Orthodox thinker, but he was very strong about this whole idea and felt that halacha had to be pushed in a new direction now. Some people think that's great, some people think that's terrible. That's not for now. Now, the last thing is page 4. Built into the system was a fascinating break, if you like, that the rabbis cannot override the will of the people. Have a look at number 14, and we'll finish with this source. The Rambam passes like this: based in Sheniru Lahem Ligzor Gezerah, if the based in decide to make a Gezerah, or Litkan Takana, or to make a Takana, a new decree, okay? Hanukkah, whatever it is, a Gezerah, there you can't drink non-kosher wines, whatever it is. Or Lahanhig Minhag, or they want to create a new Minhag in the Jewish people. This use of the word Minhag is not like we use the word Minhag. We use the word Minhag, and it means some kind of something that starts from the bottom up. People start doing stuff, and it becomes like Jewish to do that. Okay? Sneas is very based in Minhag. It depends on how people start behaving, and that creates a reality. This kind of Minhag is coming from the top down. The based in is creating new behavioral patterns within the Jewish people in order to make the religion work better. Okay? Before they do that, says the Rambam, they have to first consult. They have to do some kind of a I don't know what you call it today, not public relations consultation, but a public
policy?
Public policy, you know, investigation. The Leida Tchila, they have to know in advance. If the people are going to be able to deal with this, cope with it. Or in or if they're not going to be able to keep this. They're never allowed to create a new rabbinic law if they felt that the people are not going to be able to cope with it. It's very important. And if they did, in Vav, Harishigazru based in Gezera, they did let them make Gezera, they did their homework, they did their research. And people came back, you know, they filled in their you know, whatever they call those, the polls, the market research forms, and they said, yeah, we'll go for this gezeira. V'dimu, and they think sherov hakal yichol el amavod, that most people are holding by it. The achas shegezrua pikbeku ha'am, and then later on they realize that people are not. The loy pashta b'rov hakal, and it didn't spread through the whole people. Harizeb batela. And it's non-existent. The whole thing falls away. And they can't force the people to do it. It's very interesting. Even if they made a gezeira, thinking that the people could cope with it, but actually it turns out the people just say, you know something, we thought this would work, but I'm sorry, this doesn't work for us. The rabbi's hands are tight. The Sanhedrin's hands are tight. Okay, it doesn't happen. I'll give you a fascinating example where this happened. The rabbis introduced three areas where they prohibited things that the Torah permitted in order to achieve certain things. They prohibited wine, which was made by non-Jews, bread, which was made by non-Jews, and olive oil, which was produced by non-Jews. They prohibited all these three things. The wine, people said, yeah, we can go with that. The wine was really to prevent people intermarrying and socializing, and people said, yeah, we hear that. It's a bit of a pain, I suppose, but, you know, something we can live with it, and also we can make our own wine, we can work around that, it's fine. The bread, the people said, okay, we can kind of hope to handle that. And there is a halacha, which is on the books, which is if bread is made by a non-Jewish person privately in their own home, without a Jew being involved, the Jew is not allowed to eat it. Rabbinically, it's prohibited. If your friends decide to bake you a nice loaf of crusty bread for a party at home, and they're not Jewish, even if it's completely kosher, you've checked and the oven's kosher and the ingredients are kosher, the bread is not kosher, you can't eat it, because it's rabbinically prohibited. Stuff which is made commercially by non-Jewish bakers is permitted. Okay, there are some people who have a chumrah not to eat it, but crackers and bread and cakes and things produced by, you know, bakeries, that's okay, as long as they're kosher. Sometimes they've just got trace stuff in them, but as long as they're kosher. But when it came to the oil, the people said, you know something, that's it's not happening, sorry. You're not going to allow us to drink olive oil, to use olive oil, unless it's made by a supervised Jewish sorry. We can't live without. And even though they made the gezeira fell away and it was taken off the books. Which is really fascinating because, as I said to you before, built into the system was a certain element of the people weren't in control of the Sanhedrin, but they had a very significant influence on what the Sanhedrin could or couldn't do. Miuri, have a question?
Yeah, why is it okay if the bread is
Because they had a different din. Chazal made a specific din of a bread baked by a non-Jew in the house, and they made another din of something called pas palta. It has a different din. Pas palta is not what they prohibited. Pas palta is, what was their concern? I'm not sure. Maybe the concern was that if you go to someone's house privately and have your own dinner party with the bread and all that, that's more of an intimacy, whereas if you just go to the supermarket and you buy, you know, whichever bread which is or cakes. In England, it's not really that relevant because almost all of the bread and cakes which are made by non-Jewish bakeries are actually trade. They've got animal fats in them which make them trade. But in America, there's an enormous amount of bread and cakes and stuff on the market which is available, which is made by non-Jewish bakeries. And there are people who are machmir not to eat it. But at the end of the day, it's a chumrah. Some people are machmir on Shabbos not to eat it, even if they're not during the week. But it's a chumrah and it's not something which is halakhically required. Yeah.
So, bread that makes, like, commercially, I feel like it'll have to be, like, kosher and, like,
you have to know, it doesn't have to be supervised by a Jew, but someone has to know that it's not trade.
So, it would have to, like, have some kind of, like, sign saying that it's kosher.
Yeah, in other words, what they do is they, the OU or whoever it is, send a guy there and they investigate their systems, and they, but they don't have a guy on there watching the bread being made.
What about bakeries?
What's that? What about bakeries?
Is that commercial?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. OU has a hechsher and all sorts of things.
No, but so, like, back then, obviously, they didn't have, like, a Jew supervising, like, you know, the bakery and, like, whatever this little...
Right.
Thing. So it was just, like, if you knew there was nothing traced in the bread...
Right, okay. Right, correct. Okay. The last thing I want to say just before we leave is, what gives the Jewish people this right to influence the Sanhedrin in this very interesting way? And I brought you number 17, a one-liner, literally, which is a famous Gemara in Pesachim. It says, Hamach lehem Yisrael, leave the Jewish people alone. In other words, don't doubt the Jewish people, says the Gemara. In a Nevi'im Haim, even if they're not Nevi'im, B'nai Nevi'im Haim. They are trainee Nevi'im. B'nai Nevi'im, as we know, doesn't mean they're the children of Nevi'im. Nevi'im means that they are Nevi'im in training, they're prophets in training. In other words, they have the potential to achieve almost prophecy, and therefore the Jewish people as a whole, obviously that's talking about the Jewish people when they are they're connected with an observant lifestyle. You can't turn around and say, well, do the Jewish people, if 90% of the Jewish people don't even know what it means to keep a mitzvah, then, oh, they have certain prophetic insight that now we all have to, you know, drive on Shabbos. That's not what it's saying. What it's saying, the Jewish people, even if they're not trained as great Talmidei Chachamim, but they are, they understand what they're doing, and they're committed, and their heart's in it, and they're following halacha, so there is a certain sort of built-in collective nevuah which allows the halachic process to be driven a little bit by the grassroots, by a democratizing force down below. Okay, we are now finished with rabbinic law, and we will go on next time to talk about machlokas, and who is right and who is wrong, and can they both be right if they say the opposite stuff. Okay.